Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming to this panel. My name is Elisa Kamahort, and I'm the co-founder of BlogHer. And we're here today to talk about open source, maybe from a slightly different perspective, which is people like me, who I'm not a developer, but I use technology 24/7, wanting to understand why I care about open source. What difference does it make to me? How does it impact my life, whether the products I use are open source or not? Why should I even, perhaps according to some people, go out of my way to use open source? And so I lined up three women that I thought could convert me, and that's why we're here. So why these women? Well, to my immediate left, Annalee Newitz is a journalist, an activist, and an open source evangelist. She's a contributing editor for Wired magazine, and in a shameless act of pimping, she's going to be signing her book, She's Such a Geek, at 3:30 in the book signing place. And you all should go get her book and have her sign it. And it's all about women and technology, essays from women and technology. Further on down the road, Dawn Foster has spent 2 years blogging about open source at opensourceblog.com. And she is the director of community programs for Compere, a company that makes open source enterprise products. And in that position, she works with developers and users and partners and you know, everyone in their constituency. And all the way to the left there is Erica Rios, who is managing all of the technological and online infrastructure for the Anita Borg Institute, which is also dedicated, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing women in technology. She recently researched, presented to upper management, and is now implementing a complete overhaul of their technology/web infrastructure. And part of that research led her to recommend and them to accept some open source and some proprietary tools. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. So that's why we have these women. Now I'd like to know a little bit about you. How many of you are here because you're open source acolytes and you want to make sure that we get it right? Great. How many of you are here because you're secretly like me and want to know why you care? Okay. Great. So we have a good mix. Basically, the job, there is a part of this job that's yours too. This session, we're not going to save Q&A for the end. We're going to do it all along the way. There is a mic there. If you have a question, please go up there. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, I will repeat your question. And basically, we're looking to those of you who are open source acolytes already to make sure that we don't miss anything that the rest of us should know. And those of you who want to know why you care, if I don't express a question that you've been having, then we want to make sure we get those answered, because you've got the people here to do it, both in the audience and on the panel. So let's do it. So we're going to start with a really brief explanation of some of the basic terms of open source so that we're kind of speaking the same language. And at the same time, I think this will address some of the major myths about open source for those of us who don't know that much about it. So to me, I'll confess, and I should add, you know, my fiance works on an open source program and devotes hours to it. And I've always kind of wondered, like, why aren't you working at your real job? Why are you calling this work? This is just this thing you're doing for fun and, you know, enjoyment and because you're into it. But this is almost like playing video games, isn't it? You know? So, which I know it's not, okay. But still, I don't really get why he devotes so much time to it. So So I'm familiar with the hours spent working on open source projects. So the first question, or the first kind of myth, isn't open source free? And doesn't that just mean free? And doesn't it just mean any work you do on it has to be given back? And so it's sort of this kind of anti-capitalist, no one can make any money doing it. And so, you know, it's just an avocation and can't really be a serious thing. So that's one myth. And we're going to turn it over to Annalee first to sort of address the basics of what open source is and to, I think, debunk that myth. And, oops. There you go.
All right, so I'm going to have to offer you a definition and a slight introduction to open source in about 2 or 3 minutes, which means I'm basically the designated whipping boy here, because can you imagine trying to actually explain something as complicated as this in 3 minutes? If you're familiar at all with open source, you understand the terrible position I'm in right now. So I wanted to just really quickly go over a very, very basic definition of what open source software is. And this is basically taken directly from the Open Source Initiative website, and there's a URL up there if you want to be looking at it. I'm looking at it right now on my computer, so if you have any questions, I can check. So first of all, one of the myths is that open source is the same thing as what we called in the 90s freeware and shareware. Sometimes those terms do overlap with open source and free software. A lot of the time they don't. And they're really, those are terms that aren't really used very much in the open source community. Open source refers to, code that allows you to, that allows anyone to redistribute or create derivative works from that software. So if you release a piece of software under an open source license, other people can modify that software because they have open access to the code underlying the software. So you don't just get access to the compiled code, you get access to the source code, the stuff that actually allows you to modify it. And you can create your own software, you can package it and sell it, depending on the license. You can do a lot of other different things with it. There's dozens and dozens of open source licenses. It's really popular for people to invent new open source licenses or fork licenses from other licenses. There's a lot of different ways that can work. And also one of the other things that's very uncommonly discussed is that open source software doesn't place any restrictions on the kinds of technologies that can be used with that software. So you can't say, this software can only be used for toasters. You can't limit it in any way like that, although you can limit the kinds of licenses that people use. A couple of really common licenses that people talk about a lot are the GNU Public License, the GPL. It's basically the first open source license. It's a free software license, which is kind of a subset of open source. And it's famous for having a viral effect. It's a very radical license because anytime you use software code that's been released under the GPL and create your own software out of it, you have to release your software also under the GPL. So only if you intend to distribute it. Whatever you do in the privacy of your own home is fine.
As it should be.
Yes. So you can make special private proprietary uses of GPL software. Also the Mozilla public license I thought I would mention just because a lot of you have used Firefox, which is released under the MPL. It is similar to the BSD license in that it's something of a modification of the radical GPL. It allows you to take software code that's been released under the MPL and put it into products that are proprietary products. In other words, products that don't make their source openly available. So you can take that code, stick it into your company's product, use it, and sell that product and not make that source code available to people, which a lot of people feel sad about, but a lot of companies are very happy about. It means that that code is a lot more flexible in terms of how you can use it. And then I already sort of mentioned the BSD license, which also does the same thing. It allows you to take code licensed under BSD and put it into something that's not an open source product. And so here's my final moment where I'm just going to read some commonly used open source software names. You may be surprised. You may not have realized that some of these are open source. Firefox is under the MPL. OpenOffice, which I really love, and nobody talk crap about OpenOffice, is released under the lesser GPL. GNU Linux, of course, is under the GPL, and you better not ever call it anything but GNU Linux, or Richard will be mad. Richard Stallman, the inventor of free software. BSD is under the BSD license. WordPress is under the GPL. Apache is under its own special Apache license. Rails is under the MIT license. PHP has its own special PHP license. So these are pieces of open source software you use every day. Thank you very much. That was my quick intro.
But Annalie, before you stop, we were talking about last night. So I, as a user, I recognize WordPress, OpenOffice, Firefox, because those are applications. I don't know that I use Apache, Rails. Okay, I do. But let's say I didn't know that. I don't know that I use Apache. I really don't know what Rails does. And PHP, I know I see that in URLs. And how do I use these every day? You're saying I use them. How does it impact me that I'm using those? Where do they show up?
Well, a lot of times if you're accessing the web, you're probably getting your websites through an Apache server. So a lot of servers are running Apache and making the web available to you. PHP is also, similarly, a lot of web pages are going to be using PHP. And when you see the little .php at the end, you know you're using open source. And the reason why it benefits you as a user is that the communities who are developing that software are working in collaboration to constantly make that software better. And you see the same thing with Firefox. People are constantly releasing patches for Firefox. That's a good thing. That means that your Firefox is constantly getting better, getting more secure, hopefully more secure. And so the product is always under development, always getting better.
Well, to that point, another fear or myth about open source is this, all these people working together. Who are these people? And why should I, count on the wisdom of crowds more than the madness of crowds? And isn't it some wild west of programming? And how do I know which version to use? How do I know which plugin is good and which is bad? And I think you kind of addressed this first issue of you can't make any money, because apparently you can, which, Don's company does, right? But Don was also going to address this second question of mine, which is, how do I know with this, it seems kind of open, random, and therefore scary.
So the community is one of the things that's a little bit unique about open source. So if you think about proprietary software like Microsoft, for example, you know that there's a company, they've got a whole bunch of developers who work for their company, and that's how they create their software. The open source community is a little bit different because it's not necessarily a company. All the code isn't coming from one place. A lot of it's coming from the community. So a lot of people take a look at open source communities, and this is kind of what they see looking from the outside in. They see all of these random people contributing code, and how in the world can you end up with anything reasonable when you've got this sort of mess going on, chaotic, random, sort of free-for-all? But that's really not the way open source communities are organized, and you'd be surprised at actually how hierarchical they are if you've never participated in one. So if you look at an open source community structure, they tend to look very much like this, where, I'll actually start at the bottom of this. At the bottom of this slide, you have users. So you have people who are just using the software, random people who maybe are using Firefox or OpenOffice, or even just surfing the web like these two mentioned, and using PHP and Apache and not even knowing that they're using free software or open source software. And then one level above that, you actually have people who maybe they're not contributing code directly, but they find bugs and actually take the time to submit them. So that's a great benefit to the open source. And I would actually consider those people part of the open source community.
Would you say the percentage of people who actually submit bug reports is similar to lurkers versus active participants in any online community, which is, what, like over 90% are lurkers, and it's a really small percent that would go to the trouble of bug reports? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's true. A lot of the people that tend to submit bug reports tend to be a little bit more technical. General users tend to see a bug, and they sort of maybe don't bother to submit it. Oh, it doesn't quite work right. And then they just sort of move on. But anybody who's spent any time in development will frequently take time to submit the bug report. But yeah, there's a big difference between, and you'll notice this, and I've tried to kind of illustrate it with boxes. You know, you've got this big set of users, you've got a smaller set of people submitting bug reports. And then even smaller than that, you have people who actually contribute. And it's not just contributing code. It's also contributing documentation, information, maybe services to design the website or design the logo. There are lots of places where people can contribute to open source that's not necessarily writing code. And so then you have that smaller set of people who contribute. And then this is where you actually start to really get into the hierarchy in open source, in that there's a small set of people who are authorized to actually commit code into the open source tree. So these are the people who they're trusted community members. They have access directly to the code. So those people who are submitting bug reports, submitting contributions, they go through the committers, and the committers actually submit the code. And then above that, you have maintainers. And these are people who have the delegated responsibility of actually maintaining a certain portion of the code. So those are the people. There's usually a few of those. And they have the responsibility for actually maintaining the direction of a certain subset of the project. Like, for example, at Intel, they have the maintainers who maintain the Itanium port of the Linux operating system, for example. So they actually maintain these portions of it. And then above that, there's usually some type of leadership. So in the case of the Linux operating system, you have Linus Torvalds as the benevolent dictator, as he's frequently called. Others have board of directors. Apache's a board of directors. Some of them have a committee. So there's some type of leadership structure that leads you through this. So it's not really as chaotic as people tend to think. So there are a small group of people who tend to have control in this environment. And the control is earned through a meritocracy. So people tend to come up from the bottom. So maybe they start using a programming language. They start using Linux. They submit a few bug reports. they start contributing some code. You know, they do this for a while and people start to trust them and they get committer access. Maybe eventually they become a maintainer. But, you know, it doesn't start from the top and work its way down like a traditional corporate organization where, you know, you define the organizational structure, you put people in their little boxes, and then they go off and do their work. This is very much a bottoms-up meritocracy, which is kind of why I go through the slide from the bottom up.
So was I the only one who doesn't, you know, who's not a programmer who had no idea that all of this existed behind the open source stuff? So it was kind of comforting to hear. But the one thing it doesn't address, which I'm going to ask Erica about since she's now in a company implementing an infrastructure, including open source tools, is the other fear that I have is where's the customer support? Not to say that customer support at non-open source companies is always great. I mean, let's be fair, there's a lot of customer support that leaves a lot to be desired. But at least they at least put something up there that you're supposed to go to when you have a problem, and there's at least some mechanism that's obvious. And I don't know if that exists in the same way for open source tools. So since you're implementing this right now, tell me about that. How does it work in an open source world, customer support?
So my role at the Anita Borg Institute is basically to maintain the technical capacity of our organization. So that includes the website. And we're implementing a new website using WordPress. And we also use a series of tools that are ASP solutions, which are in fact proprietary. They're hosted on other machines, so there is a customer service function. And so me, as the staff person, I see myself as a customer to these tools, and I also see the staff people that are using the tools as customers. And so in my role, the customer support that I seek, I want help with installation, I want help with configuration, I want to know what impact that installing certain softwares are going to have on my server maintenance. You know, is it going to cron jobs? You know, what does it mean to patch this kind of software? You know, what about backups? Is it easy to do? Is it difficult to do? And, you know, oftentimes I need to hire people. So in the case of our website, we hired Kimberly Blessing and Phoebe Espiritu, who are developer and designer. And I need to know, you know, what kind of time and money I need to invest so that they have the resources they need to do the documentation and also to be sure that I hired the appropriate person with the expertise. So I have to consider all of these things and deciding what kind of customer service support I get from a tool. And then I guess in more what I originally thought is a more traditional role of customer service is sort of the staff interaction or the staff people's needs. And so first of all, I needed to know, well, does this software get the job done? There's something that actually needs to happen. So regardless of where it comes from, whether we pay for it or it's free and we have access to the source, does it do what we need it to do? And is that it, the interface that it comes with? Is it easy to use? If I provide this tool to the other staff people, are they going to be able to figure it out with or without support of the software? And so there's a self-sufficiency question. Can someone who has a problem, a user that has a problem, figure out the answer on their own, or will they have to come to me? So in a best-case scenario for the proprietary solution, you know, for me, I think of it like hardware. We are lucky enough to have Hewlett-Packard Labs donate space to us. So when I'm having a problem with one of the notebooks in our office and I can't figure it out, I can call Bailey, he's you know, down the hall, and he can come over and give me some help. Or, you know, oftentimes our machines are still on warranty, so I can call Hewlett-Packard's 1-800 number, and this great support person says, okay, take these 10 steps. And I can very efficiently resolve a problem without having to learn all the science involved with that. And so in a practical term, that's really, really helpful. I don't always need to learn the science of why something's not working. Also sort of in a web world, you know, we've decided to use Reg Online, which is a registration system, an ASP solution. They have amazing customer support. I call them all the time at no additional cost, and I find that it's just reduces kind of the stress that I have in terms of maintaining our office tool set. So I compare that to our best case scenarios using open source. So we're currently implementing in WordPress, and we hope to launch within the next month. And we will also develop an additional portion of our site using Drupal, which is also an open source solution. And what I found in a best case scenario in open source customer service is that I can go to the website and I can see that the community is friendly. What does that mean to me? Friendly means I can ask a question and I don't get someone who obnoxiously says, you know, read the freaking manual. I hate that because I obviously tried and I couldn't find the answer in the manual. So I'm asking again because whatever was available didn't suit my needs. So when someone is kind enough to just say, well, it's already in the manual and this is where you reference it, I find that to be good customer support.
So did you check, when you were looking at open source tools, was that part of your due diligence to see what the community was like, the friendliness of the community?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be some quality documentation. So what does quality mean to me again? I need to be able to find the information easily. There are lots of open source sites where I find the documentation is poor. However, I can use the documentation source I know as Google, and I can type in WordPress question, and the answer pops up even in that sense. So it doesn't have to be a hierarchical, traditional, you know, manual sort of presentation of documentation, but the community is so robust where questions are being asked and answered effectively, and other people are able to reference it, so it gets high scores and relevance when I do my search.
That's a really good point. I mean, now for a lot of tech support with my tools, I don't go to the tool site at all, even if they are a traditional, you know, have customer support. I do Google because right. I figure someone somewhere has blogged. Yeah, you have a question.
Another thing that is a situation with open source that now people recognize is that a lot of times,
yeah, please do if you don't mind.
In many cases, people don't recognize that companies offer support contracts as separate actual like things you can buy. So you have an open source tool, and then you have organizations that are willing to vet the combinations of the tools together and support that, offer a 1-800 number for you, whether it be for Red Hat or Ubuntu or any other open source project. And then the actual burden of and incentives are even in a better place that way, because instead of a company that sold you the license and they already have your money, you have a company that is actually getting your money for support. And if they provide poor support, then you will go to a different firm and get support from a different company. So the money is just for the support.
Yeah, so that's part of the economy around open source.
It's a really good point, you know, and that's what a lot of us refer to as commercial open source, which is part of what my company does, and a lot of companies do this, but the model is sort of you offer the software, and in our case, it's enterprise software under an open source license. Ours happens to be under the GPL. But then you sell support and services, you sell maintenance, you sell documentation, you sell training. So all of the stuff that you might have gotten for free with a big license fee up front, we tend to parse out, and you can purchase only what you need. So if you can get the software up and running by yourself, you don't need any of the documentation, you don't need support, then great, we'll never talk to you. We won't even know you use the software, to be honest. But then, you know, for those people who do want a little more help, who want to use it in an enterprise environment, whose CIO is more comfortable knowing that there's a company who has agreed to help when there's some issues, then most open source companies offer that as well.
Great.
Sorry. And I was going to add to that in the sense that customer support also does come in the relationship with the contractor. So I can email Kimberly and say, hey, you're a contributor to WordPress at some level, so you have expertise that I'm trying to gain right now. Can you help me with this question? And so just developing friendships, even virtually with the community, provides you a level of customer support you don't have by calling an 1-800 number. You're basically asking your friend, hey, dude, what's up? And I find that much more helpful than getting the regurgitation of the documentation from a contracted, service line. And I just wanted to add two more things in terms of the quality of documentation. When documentation, and this is like a Q&A sort of documentation I'm referring to, is written in plain language, I do have a degree in computer science, but oftentimes when people throw out the jargon, it's not helpful in terms of finding a quick resolution to the problem. But being able to get a plain language description of what it is I'm trying to address is really, really helpful. And then it also allows me to communicate the resolution to people who are less technical or less informed of what tools we're using. and just examples, you know? Like, it's great when I can spew out a bunch of stuff, like, you do this and do that. But when someone just says, here's the 5 lines of code, that goes a lot further than, you know, me trying to show how smart I am. So a quality community can demonstrate their intelligence through the quality of their product, but not necessarily feel ego-driven to demonstrate that in documentation.
Great, thanks. So we're going to move on in a minute to some of the philosophical reasons for supporting open source and some of the practical reasons. But I wanted to know, are there any other nasty rumors or myths about open source that anyone would like to put to rest or ask about because they don't know? Sure. And why don't you, I see someone back there too.
So one thing that people in big proprietary software companies always throw out as, well, it's a non-starter because of IP issues, because you just don't know where the open source came from, you don't know if people are infringing their rights, and you don't know if a big evil proprietary company is just going to come down and squash a program with a huge patent suit or something like that. And I was just wondering, since you guys deal with that all the time, if that gets bandied about and what people think about it.
That is a big question. I've heard a lot of people talk about how their management says you can't use an open source tool or a free software tool because, you know, we're worried that it will accidentally creep into our code and then we'll be sued. A lot of that comes from misunderstanding how open source licenses work, I think. And one of the big problems that I think developers have is needing to basically talk to managers about the legal ins and outs of using open source code, because, for example, it's true that if you're using code that's GPL'd and some of it winds up in your proprietary code, you're screwed because you're supposed to then release that proprietary code under the GPL, which, as I mentioned, is one of the most radical of the licenses. However, many other licenses and more commonly used licenses like the MPL, for example, which we talked about earlier, will allow you to incorporate that open source code into your product and release it as a proprietary piece of software. So a lot of times, I think what helps in those situations is if people can get either a company lawyer to come in and actually read through the license and explain to management. If you don't have access to a lawyer, which not everyone does, I mean, not everybody works at a company that has lawyers, there's a lot of legal documentation available online written by lawyers, people from places like the EFF or the Open Source Initiative or Creative Commons even has some help like that. And you can give them plain language explanations that say, yes, if we take a chunk of this code, it will be just fine. But when it comes to GPL'd code, I think that is a concern, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of people in the open source community have moved away from using the GPL, which I think is sad, but also from a business perspective, it makes a lot of sense.
And then just to add to that, there's the other concern, which I think you mentioned as well, which is the concern by management that the open source code that you're using might have somebody else's proprietary code in it. And I tend to think that it's less of a risk for open source than it is for proprietary companies. Because the open source code is out there, people tend to notice it a little bit more. So if there's proprietary code in there, somebody else might notice it and find it. The other thing is, you know, you see this in proprietary companies all the time, getting sued for some patent infringement or taking code from something they shouldn't have. And so I don't know that it's really any different between open source and proprietary companies, because you see this so much in the commercial world anyways.
Yeah, I would strongly agree with that. The fact that you can look at the code, you can demonstrate that it's free of any kind of infringing material.
And they've also, you know, in the cases where they have found that in open source projects, they tend to be able to rewrite it fairly quickly. They'll just yank the code out and rewrite it, and it usually hasn't been. I haven't seen any issues where it's been a real, real big problem.
I think, Liza, did you have a question back there? I saw you all the way in the back. No? Later. Okay. So, any other nasty rumors? Yeah. Let's put them to rest. I'm starting to feel the power.
A thing I hear a lot when I talk to people about open source is issues or concerns with security. Things like, you know, I get people saying, well, if anybody can see the code, then anybody can also find the exploits and know how it works. And generally, these are non-technical people. But at the same time, I find there's a big myth with, you know, you're putting it all out there and anybody can, you know, exploit it at that point.
I tend to worry less about exploitation, actually, with open source software than I do about commercial software, mainly because, you have so many people looking at the code, which is, there's, I think Eric Raymond coined this Linus's law, which is something about, you know, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. So you get enough people looking at it, and if the, particularly if there are security exploits, people tend to notice it. I worry more about, you know, backdoors and all sorts of things in proprietary code that I, you know, I'll never know is there. So, you know, you certainly have bugs, you have exploits, you have any of the things that you have in any other software, but I tend to worry about them less in open source just because, you know, it's the empowerment of actually being able to look at the code and know that a bunch of other people have looked at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, for example, you have security auditors who can do code review for you. You can hire them, but certainly when you have an open source community who are all auditing your code, you get things like, you know, one of the most secure operating systems in the universe, OpenBSD, which is a totally open operating system, and it's used by the military in many countries because it's such an incredibly secure lockdown system.
Great, thanks. Oh, you remember, Liza? Go ahead.
So I'm going to be the downer here.
Okay.
Because one of the issues with open source that I think that you mentioned just a little bit, but I just want to stress, is that there is a cost for making it usable for people who have no technology background whatsoever. I mean, WordPress really has a high, I mean, it's one of the most beautifully designed pieces of software that I just enjoy using. But it is hard for people who have no technology background that want to get on the web because everybody's blogging. You know, Blogger is the same thing. And Drupal, don't even get me started with Drupal. And I use Drupal for all my sites. So there is a cost. And, you know, for when people come to me or to other web developers who are using open source, they assume that there is free. That level of customer service is free, mm-hmm. and that it's going to be free, and that there's no cost on maintaining that. So it's really hard for people in the, you know, developers using open source who really are committed to using open source to actually sometimes monetize what we do, because there's not an understanding that there are ongoing costs in terms of also, you know, upgrading if there's a security issue, going to the next level in terms of, you know, whether the software downgrades or not. And so there is a cost, and I really want to stress that, because right. People have to shell money out.
To be clear, I mean, when you talk about cost, can you distinguish, are you talking about the human cost?
No, how much financial.
Financial cost. because you're paying people to assist, paying people
right.
to...
Because even if it's not the developer that does your site, you know, you still will have to get a web admin or a webmaster to understand the software to maintain it for you. So, you know, that is something that has to be allocated in budgets. And a lot of people coming into open source say, ooh, it's not proprietary, so we don't have to pay for this. And that's not the reality. So I just wanted to put that out for all the web developers. Can I get a testify?
It's an excellent point. It really is an excellent point. And Richard Stallman, Richard Stallman, who coined the term free software, refers to it as a free as in freedom, not free as in free beer.
Right.
So, you know, it is very much the free in free software is not necessarily cost. It's really about the freedom to modify, the freedom to distribute. There are costs associated with implementing it, whether it's time or money.
But I think when you're looking at a return on investment, what you partly look at is, will it be better for us in the long term to have software that we can modify for our own needs, or will it be better for us to be constantly buying a new license from Microsoft or whoever your proprietary vendor is? And I think a lot of companies, especially ones where they do have very specialized needs, you know, find that actually it might be better in the long term to hire a couple of people who are developers who can actually modify the software for their exact needs on their projects. So, yeah.
That's actually one of the considerations that the Anita Borg Institute had to take into consideration. We are using open source tools, but we have financial resources dedicated to it. So I act as the project manager for the website and also do some systems administration, but we do have contracts with a designer and a coder. So it's not as free as in beer, but it will give us the freedom, the flexibility to design our site to the specific needs of our constituents. And that is the probably one of the key philosophical reasons I decided to make the argument to management that we should have both proprietary and open source solutions. We don't get the same kind of flexibility with proprietary options.
Do you have a question?
So speaking as somebody who once upon a time had all sorts of Microsoft certifications, and as somebody who now focuses more on open source, you know, there is, I've found personally, a very large community, though, of resources when it comes to obtaining support. So thinking more about sort of the nonprofit organization, you know, if you don't like the person you're working with, there are certainly others out there that you can find. There is very little barrier to entry since it is a meritocracy. The folks that are talented and who are really working on the project and who contribute in a valuable way are going to sort of rise up and attain a certain status that, you know, if they're looking for opportunities either to help nonprofits or if they are looking for a job, there are opportunities for them. Whereas, you know, in the instance of having been, you know, Microsoft certified, that's a lot of money to pay in order to even get into that field. And yes, there is a larger community, but it doesn't bond in the same way. And, you know, honestly, you don't even have to study for half the exams in order to pass them. So, there isn't quite the same level of, I wouldn't have the same level of confidence in hiring somebody, you know, sort of to support necessarily non-open source software as
I
would.
Can I ask you, if you get to a certain level in an open source community, is there a way to validate, if you tell someone, yeah, I'm a contributor or I'm a maintainer, is there a way someone can validate it? Could people who are hiring themselves out as consultants validate what level they are in an open source community?
People have used me as a reference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll get telephone calls and I'll test to what they do.
Usually the...
Okay.
Yeah, but most projects, there'll be a website or there'll be some area where you can see listed, like, these are the contributors, these are the maintainers.
Absolutely. I think I now that I've gone through this process, I look at who's contributed certain amounts of code and how much of their code is actually being accepted in. So their acceptance rate is a huge indication on the quality of their work.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because the thing about open source software is you actually get to see your developer's code in use before you hire that person, either as a consultant to do some freelance stuff for you or even as an employee. If you look at some of the open source projects, MySQL is a pretty good example of this. Most of the people they've hired were people who contributed to their community and became really good at it, and MySQL eventually offered many of them jobs, and that's how a lot of the commercial open source companies even do their recruitment. But, you know, even just as a consumer of open source, you actually can go out and you can look and you can see what their code looks like before you decide whether to hire them.
Great. You have a question?
Well, I'd like to talk about reliability and continuity. If you're a company that needs a very specialized tool and it's, and say it's proprietary, and the company that's making the tool goes out of business, then where are you? But if it's open source, you can always maintain it yourself or get somebody else to maintain it.
That's
it. And another thing that's kind of related is this cryptography and the whole thing with the voting machines. If the source isn't out there, there's always somebody smart enough to write a cryptography scheme that's so clever that they can't see what's wrong with it. But the community, if the source is out there, the community can see what the mistakes are and how it's available to be broken. And all these voting machines have been broken very quickly. And we need, as American people, we need to get the source out there so that we can make sure that when we cast a vote, it actually happens.
Well, thank you so much for saying that, because it was in my notes. We're going to move into sort of some philosophical reasons. And it was in my notes that I wanted to make sure someone up here addressed this voting machine issue, because someone explained that to me and it resonated with me. And so now we don't have to do it, because you just articulated it very well. But let's talk about the philosophy, the sort of philosophical reasons for supporting open source. And I just want to ask, how many of you buy organic food? Do you pay more for that, do you think? Yeah. How many of you care about fair trade coffee? Anybody? Right? These are, you know, I'm a vegan. Any vegans or vegetarians? Woohoo! Okay. So in other parts of our lives, we make decisions, economic decisions about what we spend our economic vote on, our dollars from our wallet, based on what some would say are philosophical, ethical, emotional reasons. I mean, how many of you don't go to Walmart or don't go to Starbucks or don't go to some other companies that could identify, not to pick on them, but they're easy to pick on. But so the question is, how many of you make technological decisions in the same way and consider open source to be that kind of decision? And should we? Can we? So do you have a comment or you can go ahead?
I was just thinking, like, how do you envision, like, corporate responsibility? Like, people are like, yay, it's free, it's cool. But what about contributing back to the community? Like, how will companies start to look at that as a responsibility?
Well, I know that a lot of companies actually do have representatives who work on open source projects. And actually, I also know that, so is Kalia here? Kalia Hamlin? She was at a conference we were at recently where she was really trying to encourage non-programmers, non-developers to get involved themselves with the open source communities because she felt that open source communities needed to hear more from the users and that would be a contribution. But it's extremely intimidating. I mean, I can tell you, as I'm a wannabe geek, I would love to be a better geek, but the idea of doing that is extremely intimidating. But there's that idea of it would help contribute to the greater good. So we're going to talk a little bit about the philosophical reasons and start with you, Annalie. And what do you think is the sort of ethical reason we should be caring about open source?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a lot of good technological reasons to be using open source. And I think that's, you know, really important to sort of put foremost. And in a sense, that's a kind of ethics because, it's ethical to choose a solution that's going to have the greatest benefit for the most people, which is, you know, also part of what a good economic or technological solution will do. Also, of course, from an ethical point of view, I mean, we were talking about sort of organic food or fair trade. And I do think that when you have a product that's created by a community that is either donating its time or people who are being, a company is giving them like a 20% amount of their time to give back to an open source project like a lot of companies do. I think that you simply get a higher quality because people are working together, checking each other's work, having conversations about it. And it's a product that they actually care about. And it's a product, not only do they care about it, but they own it. When you produce something for Microsoft, Microsoft owns it. I'm picking on Microsoft, and I really shouldn't because they're, like, not as evil as some other companies at this point. Like, they're kind of in the dark ages of their evil, the decline of their evil. Or, I don't know how to explain it, but I feel like there's, like, I feel like Google is the new Microsoft, and they're, like, the new evil or whatever. But actually, they use a lot of open source, so maybe it's like a friendly new evil. But what I'm trying to say is that when you produce...
Isn't that a sign of the coming apocalypse, friendly evil?
But what I'm trying to say is that when you produce software that's proprietary and your company owns it, there's a sense in which that software becomes alienated from you. It's a product that you put love into it, but you don't get to keep it at the end of the day. But with open source software and free software, you put your love into it and then you can play with it and you own it. And it's something that you can deploy on your machines or you can mess with it or tinker with it or you can find security holes in it and brag to your friends and then fix the security holes. And don't just write exploit code. So I think that's one of the things to me that's most important is I feel like people are not alienated from what they create when they create open source software because it's something that they can take home at the end of the day instead of having to pay a license for it, even though they've built it.
Yeah. And so getting back to the voting concerns that you mentioned, so I'll address the ethical part of it kind of from a government perspective, but you know, and mostly from a U.S. government perspective, because, you know, I can talk mostly about the government that I'm a part of. But, you know, so much of the government that we have here in the U.S. is based on transparency, you know, and it's supposed to be a government, you know, by the people, for the people. But, you know, it's the reason we have things like C-SPAN, where you can go, you can watch on TV all of the proceedings, you can read about them. And, you know, from my perspective, the voting machines should be similar. You should be able to go out and look at that code and see what they're doing and make suggestions or corrections if there are some issues with it. But because it's not been transparent, there are all sorts of issues with it where, you know, people don't know if their votes are being counted. In some cases, they found that the counting was not correct for whatever reason or another. But, you know, I do think that the transparency is a big, for me, kind of a philosophical advantage of the open source is that the whole community is transparent. The code is transparent. You can go out and you can really see what's going on in the project. So for me, I think that's a big philosophical concern.
So the Anita Borg Institute's primary mission is to be sure that women are equal partners in leading the creation of technology. And when I think about the philosophical reasons people should be committed to using open source, at least a part of the time, is access. So I think about it like the public library system. What if we only allowed proprietary software? And so now you go into the library and you have to have money to check out a book. We no longer have access to intellectual knowledge. We no longer have the ability to self-learn, to self-teach, to share our knowledge with others. And I think that undermines democracy. It also undermines learning. And so how is it that women can be equal contributors in leading and creating technology if they don't have access to that intellectual knowledge? We know that there are systemic barriers to women achieving technical degrees in the university system. We know that it goes all the way down to the kindergarten level. There are systemic reasons that girls and women often drop out of technical degrees and things of that nature. So the key is access, and open source provides a unique opportunity for all women, and for that matter, all people, regardless of socioeconomic status, to have access to knowledge that's otherwise unavailable to them. If all software code was proprietary, I would have never looked at a piece of code in my life. I can't afford it, period. And I would say, you know, reasonably well off. And so for me, it's really a commitment to open source is really a commitment to giving everyone an opportunity to contribute to the scientific revolution that's impacting our politics, our economics, and our social well-being. So it's really an issue of democracy and participation. Dr. Fran Allen was just announced as a Turing Award winner. And Fran is someone who works closely with the Anita Borg Institute. If you don't know, the Turing Award is kind of like the Nobel Prize of computer science. And she's the first woman since its inception to grant this award. You know, I think it's highly likely that a girl, perhaps, in the high school level right now, who has access to open source code, may find a supportive community that will allow her to achieve something as great as Fran. Fran had access to that knowledge. She had the potential. She had the interest. And so by giving other people the opportunity access to that information, it gives them greater opportunity to be successful at this level and contribute at higher levels. So I think it's probably a key consideration in us achieving equality between amongst the genders in the technical field. And I think what we'll find is innovation will reach new heights as we increase the participation of all types of people, men and women of all diversities into this process.
Thanks.
Jory. So I just want to be a devil's advocate for a second. And I hate to sound like such a capitalist, but someone had mentioned that that just by virtue of being a private company, you can't really rely on the software. I would think almost the opposite. There was a really interesting project called the Wisdom of... Is Rob May here? He ran the Wisdom of Crowds. He's here somewhere, but he's not in this room. But he ran an open source business project, and the business never took off because people didn't have the motivation, aka pay. So there's a lot of passion, but at least... I'm just wondering if money means motivation, if money makes it easier to commit, because people were flowing in and out of this project. And you're saying people are actually taking time and kind of building the ranks. That gives me a better sense of how there's accountability with open source. But I'm still trying to understand what is the motivation for an engineer, a developer, to bother.
Well, money is not, I mean, certainly there is money in open source, as we've already established. But I would also want to point out that there are lots of other kinds of rewards that people work for. I mean, we're here at a conference where there's a lot of artists. I don't know if you've noticed, they like you know, walk around and they have music instruments and things like that. Those are people who are working, hoping maybe one day to make money, but a lot of times they're doing it because they want to get people to appreciate their work. And within the open source community, there is a lot of that artist ethic where people work because they want to create something beautiful and be acknowledged for it. It's also the fundamental, sort of structure underlying something like Dig. Why do people get so obsessed with Dig? You know, why do they want more, you know, why do they want to have a higher reputation on Dig? Well, they're not getting money for it. I mean, some of them are getting money, apparently. But
but on a practical level, isn't there also an element where people work on projects because they're using them in their daily lives as well, and they want to make their lives, their working lives, easier? So isn't there an element of self-interest to for a lot of people who work on this
stuff? Actually, that's a really, really good point. I think there's an element of self-interest. There's an element of doing something good that the community will acknowledge, and then the community uses it, and so everybody says, great, you've made my life better too. And also, you know, in the end, you're going to make, if you can make your work life better through open source, you may make more money. Also, people can use it, I mean, you know, crassly, people do use it on their resumes, of course, to get a better job, to say, look, I worked for 4 years for free doing this kick-ass thing, now pay me.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Let me just add to that a little bit. You know, every time they've done a study on the motivation behind people contributing to open source, the motivations have been across the board. You know, everything from I want to, you know, learn and have an example on my resume to I want to be a rock star like Linus Torvalds, and, you know, to I want to be, you know, any of these other things. And there are lots of motivations. And for those people who are more financially motivated, it's very interesting because even the pure open source projects like the, you know, Linux operating system, which does not have a company behind it. If you look at the contributors to the Linux kernel, a lot of them come from IBM or from Intel or from Oracle or from Red Hat, where they pay people who full-time do nothing but contribute to those projects, because there's a certain motivation by that company to have that software run really well on their hardware or with their databases or with whatever. So there's motivation across the board, and depending on what that motivation is, there are different ways to serve it.
Thanks. Let's go to
I definitely wanted to dispel that there's anything inherently anti-capitalist about open source and free software. Definitely. In fact, I would probably say more of the people I've encountered in the open source community are of more of a libertarian persuasion mm-hmm. than anything like anti-capitalist. And furthermore, in terms of like this whole idea of self-interest and profit, we actually, part of the reason my company went more toward open source is because we were spending so much time, energy, and just emotional capacity chasing after clients on intellectual property issues with just trying to enforce the copyright and try to use licenses, that we were finding we were getting a better rate for our time just offering it as consulting services around it and just releasing the software for free than we were spending just trying to do it the proprietary way.
Thank you.
So I would also like to add a little bit in the sense that it's kind of an interesting question. I mean, the group of people who are most likely to work for free are women. If you look at the number of volunteers, women do an overwhelming majority of volunteer work in our country at the very least, and I would guess globally. So the motivation to work is there. And I think that there's a lot of like stereotypes that we often will default to when trying to figure out what it is that's not quite working. So, for example, in a community setting, you know, there's probably a lack of supportive cultures. I was once asked by someone from the Mozilla Foundation, you know, what is it we could do to retain more women contributors? And my answer is, I don't know. Ask the ones that are there and ask the ones that are leaving. So there are a lot of motivations for participation. I don't think we've clearly determined what those are, so we can retain more people into that process. So money's not the only issue. Although, you know, if you're a woman contributing code, go get money for it if you can. I mean, please.
Thanks. Yeah.
But, and not to continue to cheapen the discussion, I think that one of the harmful myths about open source is that there isn't money in it. And you're saying, you know, women, we tend to work for free, but also anyone that has ideals tends to work for less money or work for free. But as a business manager of a successful open source software consulting and education company, we experience a lot of times people that will say to us, oh, well, there's not very much money in that. And we think, okay, sure, you can keep charging less, that's fine. But I think that that's one of the myths that keeps developers and also non-developers away from open source, in that it has this kind of like, kind of smells like patchouli a little bit, you know, it's kind of hippie. And,
yeah.
And so we tend to shy away from it. But I think that that's one of those things that ought to be dispelled, in that, yes, it's not free, but it's also not cheap.
Right.
And so there's value to it in a lot of intrinsic ways, but there's a monetary value to what's going on as well.
I think there are many analogies for this. And in the theater, you know, actors, more than any other segment of working on a theatrical production, are the ones who will work for nothing. You will not find musicians in an orchestra or a pit. I don't know about, you know, people who are doing their own stuff, but you will not find even a piano player at a staged musical reading who plays for free. The musicians have a totally different, and no, the set designers don't do it for free. The director doesn't do it for free. The choreographer, the actors will do it for free. And I used to say bloggers were like the actors of the internet, because bloggers are like so excited someone would want their writing that they're like, oh, I'll give it to you, you know, and they weren't charging people. When professional blogging and blogging consulting and all of those things started becoming actual, you know, vocations a couple of years ago, people were totally underselling, because there was this sort of passion or artistic sense to it that seemed to translate into, so I shouldn't be able to get a lot of money for it because I love doing it. And why shouldn't we love doing what we get paid to do? Why shouldn't we love our work, right? And so I think that sounds like open source has a similar kind of, if you're passionate about it and you love it, you give it away, and there's always segments of our society that do that, but I don't think there's any reason it should be, right?
You don't give it away. You just convince your boss that you should be devoting 50% of your time to doing it, because it'll make, you know, the whole work situation easier, you know? So,
and I have to say, it's nice to see so many women on the board.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I don't know if this is a stupid question or just a simple one or whatever, but I just don't understand something, like, fairly fundamental, I think. So if someone could help set me straight, that'd be great. This may tie in a little bit to what you were saying about Google being evil, but I don't know. I don't think so. What I'm wondering is, where is the boundary? Where is the line? Where is the distinction of building kind of proprietary products on top of the mesh, the ecosystem, the layers, you know, of open source software? Because, you know, you mentioned derivatives and the viral effect of you know, the GNU Linux license. Mm-hmm. Like, how far does that extend, and why, like, where is the limit to that? Is that defined specifically in the license itself, or is that just a community convention that's grown up that you can build sort of proprietary products using, you know, for example, the open source LAMP stack? Like, how when you stitch those together in certain ways, why is that suddenly not an open source product?
So that's a good question. And in fact, it's something that gets debated a lot in the open source community. It's not by convention at all. All of these things, in terms of how you're able to incorporate open source or free software into your software, what you're able to build on top of it, are spelled out in the licenses. And in fact, there's a huge debate over the new GPL license, over how that's going to work and how something like Google actually does fit into that license. And I suspect what's going to happen is Google is going to stick with the old GPL license, because I think the new, well, it's hard to say what's going to happen with the new one, but the point is that this is all in the license, how it is that you're able to incorporate free software or open source software into your product. And so it's really important in the open source community that people be a little bit geeky about licensing and a little bit geeky about legal language, and learn something about it, because it is true that you may end up tripping over a license that you weren't, and realize, oh, I actually can't do this. But most commonly used licenses now, like the Mozilla public license, there isn't as much difficulty around these questions because of the fact that the license allows you to incorporate open source code into a proprietary product. So the lines can get blurred very easily. The derivative works, there's a lot more flexibility in the kinds of derivative works you can create, which goes back to the point that we were making earlier about making money, which is, yeah, you can create a proprietary product and make a ton of money on it and not let anybody see your code.
But it seems like the bottom line is that before using any open source for a product, the first thing
read
to do
license.
Is read the license. Yeah. So we are actually like in our last minute. I'll take one more.
You don't even have to comment on this. I was just curious though how that relates. There's rumors about Google has sort of their own version of Ubuntu, like a Gubuntu or something like that. Not available to the public? But I'll leave it.
So sorry, I think we can only take one more question, and then we'll be here for a little while because there's nothing in this room afterwards.
Okay.
Sorry.
Is this my question?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is really quick. From my perspective, I'm both a non-developer and an open source acolyte. I have a calculator on my computer. I really enjoy using it. It adds numbers. I don't want to learn how to program it or make it better. Some people probably do. On the other hand, I work every day to implement MediaWiki and Movable Type into how our company works on a day-to-day basis. And I really dig that that's open source, and I can hack it up as much as I need. I was wondering how far somebody who's interested in becoming like an open source acolyte should go. How interested they should be in making everything open source, or just picking their battles and saying that, you know, the calculator doesn't necessarily need to be open source, but I want Movable Type.
You mean
to be
making
open
the
source.
Case to your company to do this, or just in your
or just
own?
To people in general? Like how much of the Kool-Aid should I drink?
I can,
should everything
like
be open
how
source?
Hardcore do you need to be before like you can say that you're into open source?
I can address that, and the bottom line for me is how much do I want to hack it? So the things that we clearly decided will not be open source at this time for our organization, I say at this time, is our CRM system, our constituent relations management software. We have no interest in customizing that. We wanted to interact with our accounting system. We're not inventing new ways to do accounting technology. We're not interested in that. Our primary interest is in bringing people who believe in our mission together to work towards social change. So having the ability to customize our web solutions to that end is very, very important. And if we don't have extreme control over that process, then we're limiting our potential to see our mission through. So really, when my bottom line is, if we don't need to hack it to make it more interesting to better suit our needs, let's not do it. Let the people who do it well do it for us.
Great. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you to my panelists.